Honourable Members, good morning and welcome to all of you. The purpose of today's meeting is to receive a briefing from the Office of the Public Protector on the strategic plan and budget for the following financial year. And we've been looking forward with great anticipation, Madam. So let me hand over to you. Yamos.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members of Parliament. I thank you again for this opportunity to address you and brief you on the strategic plan of the Public Protector. This is the third strategic plan that my team and I has created since I came into office. And it is presented to you as a basis for the accountability of this office in terms of Section 182 of the Constitution. Honourable Chairperson, our former President Nelson Mandela once said, there is no peace without democracy. And we all know that democracy is about government of the people by the people. And traditionally, it was about government by elected representatives of the people and on the understanding that there's a contract between the people and those they have elected and which they continue to elect every 5 years. But we've now come to know democracy as having three essential elements: representation, dialogue and accountability. And in your wisdom, this Parliament created Chapter 9 institutions to support you in exacting accountability in the exercise of public power, but particularly to curb excesses in administrative actions of the state. I therefore thank you for this privilege to talk to you about our strategic plan, which is a plan for how are we going to assist you and the people of South Africa in ensuring that there is optimal accountability in the exercise of administrative power within the state. When I started, Honourable Chairperson, as a public protector, I was asked, how are you going to make this office? How are you going to ensure that this office makes a difference? It's not just a forum that offers hope, but in the end, there is no justice for the people. I recall that I used the symbol of an umbrella and said that my sense of it was that we were going to make this office an umbrella where people who feel they've been hurt by administrative actions of the state could come to the office. Honourable Chairperson, I was wrong. When I worked with the team, we came with a different vision, a vision that didn't see the office as an umbrella and therefore a refuge, a place of refuge for the people, because that was not what the Constitution drafters had in mind. They had in mind a buffer between those who exercise administrative power and the people. They had in mind somebody or an institution that was going to give people a voice and at the same time assist the state to listen better when people were talking. We changed our symbol, therefore, from an umbrella, Honourable Chairperson, to a makatsi, which is makatsi is an institution within one of our traditional communities in this country, which doesn't replace government. It is an institution that assists when direct accountability between government and the people has been broken. It moves in, the institution moves in to mend that relationship and to improve accountability. It is on that basis, Honourable Members and Honourable Chairperson, that we present our strategic plan, the third since I became Public Protector. The vision in the strategic pledge, Honorable Chairperson, really has not changed. I will talk to you about it very quickly. My presentation is going to cover very quickly an introduction, which will talk to what has changed and why things have changed. Our achievements, or key achievements, in supporting democracy as a dialogue between the state and citizens. Thirdly, what have we retained in the existing strategy? Fourthly, what really has changed? I'll talk very briefly about our challenges, Honorable Chairperson. Then I'll talk very briefly to you about what are we asking you to pay for in the new strategy. What are the key things we've budgeted for? Then the CEO will talk about the detailed budget. But from my side, it will be what are the key things we've budgeted for. I will then make a special request to Parliament as usual, just a few things where we need Parliament support, which we are grateful that previously we have received that support, hence we continue to play our part in supporting and strengthening democracy. And then the last slide will be conclusion and appreciation. I will now go to the introduction, Honorable Chairperson. Honorable Chairperson, as I have indicated, our strategic vision remains as articulated in the original Public Protector Vision 2020, which is a vision that we had for a 10-year period, and we are on the third year of that period. Why hasn't the strategy changed, Honorable Members and Chairperson? It's because a strategy is something that looks at a long range, and within a short space of time, it's not advisable to change your strategy. You can review the strategy or tweak it a bit. So that's what we have done. In other words, we have tactical changes as opposed to major strategic changes. However, where we have made some changes, it has been primarily because we have listened to feedback that we've received from this portfolio committee. Particularly, the feedback we received was on what are we doing with the little money that we're given before we ask for more money. How are we stretching what we have to do as much as possible before we ask for more? We are going to be talking about what have we tried to do to stretch what we have with a view to trying to do more. We've also listened to stakeholders, primarily those that were concerned that we seem to be emerging as an anti-corruption agency, which is an important function we perform under the Prevention and Combating of Corrupt Activities Act, read with the Public Protector Act, but it is our secondary mandate. A lot of them wanted to see how do we reposition ourselves to ensure that there's accessibility for all persons and communities as envisaged again in Section 182 of the Constitution. Particularly accessibility to rural communities, young people, children, older persons, persons with disabilities, women, and people of foreign origin, among other marginalized groups. We've listened again to stakeholders, and we've tried to incorporate those concerns in our strategic plan. We also listened to opinion voices from experts in society that we met during the Public Protector Stakeholder Good Governance Week. And again, we've incorporated the views that emerged during the Good Governance Stakeholder Week. Again, one of the views that emerged there was the importance of using our soft power a lot as opposed to using our hard power, especially when we're dealing with administrative infractions of the state. And again, that's something we've built into our strategy. And those primarily were some of the things that we had to listen to. Honorable Chairperson, we've also looked at the fact that our environment itself is changing. As a country, we are operating in Africa where there's been an Arab Spring and people becoming a little bit edgy about service delivery. And one of the things people have asked us is, how do we make sure that we don't only handle complaints that come at a time, but we leave a lasting legacy that builds the relationship between organs of state and the people and limits repeat acts of maladministration within institutions we've dealt with. That is an area where we have stepped in and tried to play our part. You will know, for example, we stepped into the Balisang and again we are beginning to step into more of those communities where we see ourselves as part of strengthening democracy. Is about strengthening people's trust in constitutionally sanctioned processes, that people should trust in avenues that have been created by the Constitution for dialogue between them and the state before they resort to what we call extrajudicial means. Honorable Chairperson, when it comes to issues such as the mandate, we have retained the mandate as it is. And when it comes, we've retained our mandate, we've retained most of the things that we have. But in terms of strategic objectives, I have indicated that we've looked at some of the feedback that we've got. Some of the changes that we've also made have had to do with both our successes and our weaknesses. So the strategy seeks to do more of the things that we did well and even perfect those, whilst making sure that those things that we didn't do so well, we respond to them and we begin to mend the parts of our organization that do not do well. I will speak to you about our refocus on the strategy, for example, on issues such as governance and skills, governance values and internal skills. Let me just talk very briefly, Honorable Chairperson, about then what did we achieve. In the past year, Honorable Chairperson, we investigated 26,440 complaints. These are unaudited figures, Honorable Chairperson, so we are still waiting for an audit. We will still come back to you on our annual report in October with audited figures. So if we end up with one less complaint or something like that, let us not be seen as having tried to mislead you. But this is what we, from our side, we've picked up. This is how these complaints were constituted. 20,219 new complaints were received during the year under review. And we had carried from the previous year 5,609 complaints. We finalized 16,509 complaints and we carried through. You'll notice that the number of complaints we finalized in the year under review was higher than the previous one, and the number of complaints we received was much higher than the previous one. The number of complaints that we received increased by about a little over 6,000. What the figures are not telling you is the fact that the increase in the number of complaints was not just the quantity of complaints that increased. The complexity of complaints also increased. So our disposal rate has increased, but on small matters. Our disposal matter on our disposal rate on complex investigation has increased on service delivery ones, but on some of the other ones, the conduct failure ones, has not increased significantly. The service failure ones, our disposal rate did increase because we didn't focus on reporting. We focused on justice. So something that would have been complex and would ordinarily have ended up in a report was resolved around the table, with people sitting around the table, and we facilitated that. So increasingly we've been using our ADR powers to make sure that we resolve cases around the table. We can give you numerous examples of those that were resolved around the table, and we didn't have to report, including cases that are not ordinarily what you call maladministration, traditional maladministration, matters involving delictual claims against the state and even contractual failure against the state. Perhaps one example I can give here, Honorable Chairperson, is a case where the complainant was owed by an organ of state money. I will not mention them by name because they cooperated very well and we don't want them to lose clients. But the complainant was owed money by an organ of state, and he was banking with them, and then his money disappeared one day. And when he approached them, they said he was a victim of fraud, but they were not sure whether he was part of that fraud. When we conciliated this matter, it was clear that the organ of state was at fault. We sat around the table. The organ of state was at fault in that when the money was withdrawn, this was a pensioner, and they withdrew 50,000 from his account. And the way it happened was the new person presented an ID and said they had lost. They came and said they presented a temporary ID and said they'd lost their bank details, their bank card and everything, and can they be given a new bank card? And on the one day the person got a new bank card. They went away and with the temporary ID. The following day they came back and emptied their account. Now, a few days later, the complainant came and wanted to withdraw his money, because he used to withdraw it in small amounts. He discovered that most of it was gone. The organ of state said, well, we thought you took away your money because you came, according to our records, you came. And he said, I didn't come. But what we checked, we found that the person who came to withdraw the money was younger. This man was a pensioner. And two, the ID that was presented was, even though it was a temporary ID, with just a little bit careful look, I'm not a fraud examiner, but on first look at it, I could tell that it was fraudulent. It didn't have fingerprints. It did not have, the picture of the person was a young person coming to claim as a pensioner, and lastly the signatures were different. But anyway, we sat around the table and we resolved it, and the organ of state eventually at the end of that meeting undertook to go and think about it, and a day later they came back and they said they will pay, and by Christmas time the pensioner had his money at the bank. So ordinarily, yes, we would have reported on it and then chased to the state to get a remedial action. So most of the administrative infractions of the state have been resolved through such a conciliation by at our level between me and the public protector, but also we're training our staff. A lot of them now are doing conciliation meetings like this. It works faster, but it also promotes dialogue again between organs of state and complainants, and it also provides the state with an opportunity to be informed around principles of good administration. Because when we conciliate, we talk about what happened and then what should have happened. What does proper conduct as envisaged in Section 182 mean? What does good administration as the opposite of maladministration require? So when we come out of that, there is a lesson that has been learned by the state. So, which for us, we believe that's what you as Parliament intended when you added this particular institution in addition to the courts to facilitate dialogue between the state and you. Now, as you can note in the new slide that I'm about to present, we have received an increase in a number of our complaints. Can we just have the slide that just shows that this is what has happened over a three-year plane of honourable members. The year under review is in green. And the previous years, the year preceding that one is the one in maroon, and then we have blue for the third year. You can see then that there's been a bit of a steady increase in a number of cases that we have investigated totally. I will just also want to indicate, though, that the number of cases we brought forward did increase, primarily because of the increase in the number of cases, but more importantly, though, was because our outreach activities increased towards the end of the term, and then a lot of the cases were still new anyway, and therefore they were not dealt with. As I've indicated, we are trying to resolve everything primarily through, the next slide, through ADR, and therefore we are investing a lot in improving our ADR capacity. But even our investigations, we have shifted honourable members from the kind of call centre type of investigations. We do those for our early resolution, but when we investigate. So that eats a lot into our resources, but it's value for money because we are getting justice. We're not getting a situation whereby when we've exited a case, the complainant still feels that if we had dug a little harder, we could have decided in their favor. Examples in this regard would be in the area of, for example, home affairs. Now that we investigate a little bit harder, we don't just listen to home affairs saying, okay, the person did not qualify for an ID. Our investigators sit and review the law themselves. So when home affairs comes and says, now this person must go to Mozambique and go in and apply for an ID there, as one of the cases we had recently suggested. We have quickly looked at our own, done our own study into the legal framework, and we see that now you get your citizenship through all of your parents, and therefore there's no reason why a child or a teenager must be sent to Mozambique to do that. So in the past, those things would go on forever because you would be listening a little bit to the state, which the state obviously is trying to assist us, but sometimes in trying to assist us, they also don't look at the law. What does the law say? So that's what has helped in the fact that we've increased our capacity and therefore our responsiveness. Well, in the period under review, we've also strengthened our outreach, education in communities, in communicating activities. We believe that we have reached our target of at least 10 million a year in terms of the people that we reach out to. We reach out to people through various media, particularly outreach activities where we go into communities, mainly in the rural areas and the townships, and then we do the annual stakeholder consultative exercise and the good governance work. Those help, but also media briefings that we do also help us to reach as many people as possible. We can gauge that we have reached more people because we did two surveys just now. Two surveys that are looking at what do people think about our office. And we found from those surveys that there is an increased number of people that know about the office that are beginning to know what can it help them with. From your side, honourable members, you will hear that it's often said that the public protector is seen as an anti-corruption agency that works on high-profile cases. The feedback we're getting from communities is that people know that we are there for the ordinary person. And not only do they know, they tell others, because others come and say, so-and-so told me that. And the feedback that we got through the surveys confirmed that there are more people from the various communities that know that when you have a dissatisfaction, when you are dissatisfied with administrative treatment from an organ of state, you can take the matter to the public protector. I've mentioned that one of the ways we reached out to people was through our Good Governance Week, where the main focus is always to profile the office and get more people to know about it. But through this vehicle, we've also promoted a national dialogue around good governance, which is our aim, of course, is that our aim is not just to deal with one administrative infraction. Part of the impact we seek to make is to make sure that the state consistently acts with good administration. People are treated fairly, and people are treated responsively, and ultimately the state is able to account, or state actors are able to account for their actions at all times. Parliament asked us to have a clear footprint of how we are going to roll out our services. We had presented one to you as a vision, but rather than as something concrete. And when we were here, we were told, but you have too many offices, for example, in some of the provinces, and no offices in others. You will see in the strategy, honourable members, that we've relocated some of our offices. Mpumalanga, we've relocated one of our offices in Gauteng, one of our offices in Mpumalanga. We have also looked at the belt that one honourable member was unhappy with. We're considering relocating at least one or more of those offices, but we haven't taken a firm decision because it would be maladministration in terms of labour relations to then announce and say, for sure, we are moving with that office. From our exco, we've targeted, we know what we're trying to do, but we are then going to consult in terms of labor relations around how do we relocate that office. Yes, ma'am. Yes. So again, that's the footprint. The other thing that we were asked was look at other ways you can reach out to people. We did, and one of the things we looked at was relocating those existing offices or redistributing what we have. We also considered stretching out our mobile office to all the 9 provinces. Instead of having MOB only in 3, which was a pilot, we decided then we move and have MOB as part of our thing. And then we also have been working with NGOs to look at leveraging our relations with them to use their centers to reach out to more. And in this regard, we also looked at government. We've spoken to GCIS about using the Tusong centers as a way of reaching out to more people. We had a meeting with GCIS, and in our new strategy, we are also looking at an opportunity to engage the post office as another possibility for reaching out to people without adding to new offices. Obviously, the footprint does still look at, in terms of a long term, the possibility that at some stage we could have an office in every district, because it's easier for people if the ombudsman is located close by. But that is our long-term vision. Reduction, another area of achievement is reduction in our turnaround times. More than 50% of our complaints we finalize within 3 months. We've also reduced the number of cases that are older than a year. And but I must say that, honorable members, is that we're still growing in terms of the areas of improvement. Hence, I will talk to you a bit later about what is the focus of our strategy. We have begun to revisit our performance management system, which to make sure that it rewards the kinds of behavior that is fully in sync with the promise we've made to the people of South Africa, which I'm going to talk about it. The promise comes from our strategic objectives, and never reward people who violated that promise. We are looking at that. We also have looked at, we've had leadership engagements to look at how do we lead an organization that is purpose-driven, but looking at multiple layers of leadership, not saying the leadership of the organization is just the deputy public protector and the CEO, looking at everyone right up to middle management as leaders of the organization and say what kind of values should drive your behavior. And second but last, skills. We also have been looking at improving our skills, particularly in the area of ADR and investigation capacity, including forensic investigation capacity. So we've done training guys, investigation guides, and we trained very briefly, but we trained our external panel, and we have scheduled training that will take place for our internal investigators. That was internal training, but external training was provided on a course called Sharpening Your Teeth, where all our investigators were put through a course called Sharpening Your Teeth. And that has improved significantly in terms of our ability to investigate. Our vision, Honorable Chairperson, is to have a seamless organization where people don't need to know who is the public protector, where people don't need to ask for anyone in their organization when they have their case. They will receive excellence, even though they go to some of the provinces that I do know that everyone is concerned about. And we do have in our plan a strategy for those provinces. Perhaps I should be open and say we do have in the strategy where we talk about focusing on at least 2 provinces per year where we have picked up witnesses. And in the current strategy, we said we are going to focus on 2, which is Eastern Cape and KZN. So that's part of having seamless, or trying to generate seamless excellence in the entire organization. So what have we retained, Honorable Chairperson? The mandate is ongoing. It comes from the Constitution. It stays the same. We investigate conduct in state affairs or in the public administration in any sphere of government that is alleged or suspected to be improper or to result in any impropriety or prejudice, to report on that conduct and to take appropriate remedial action. We also are still aiming to be accessible to all, to be accessible to all persons and communities. Our vision remains the same, Honorable Chairperson, a trusted, effective and accessible public protector that rights administrative wrongs and consistently acts with integrity to ensure fair, accountable and responsive decision making, service and good governance in all state affairs and public administration in every sphere of government. That we retain. Our mission remains the same, which is to strengthen constitutional democracy in pursuit of our constitutional mandate by investigating, rectifying and addressing any improper or prejudicial conduct in state affairs and resolving related disputes through mediation, conciliation, negotiation and any other measures to ensure fair, responsive and accountable public sector decision making and service delivery. We have changed our core principles. We've changed our core values, not our core principles. Our core principles remain the same. And those are the core principles that we also encourage in government. They are accountability, integrity, and responsiveness. Because we believe that if you tie everything into those three, you get a state that operates as required by the Constitution. We used to have 10 values. We have changed them into 5 because we wanted values that people can try and remember all the time so that we can integrate them into our day-to-day behavior. And I thought if there's fewer, it's easier for people to remember them and to integrate them into day-to-day behavior. So the values are now as follows: independence and impartiality, human dignity and ubuntu, transparency, equality and fairness, redress. You'll notice that the value of justice is no longer there, and we have moved it elsewhere, and it's not one of the core principles. That's a typographical error where we have core principles. Our core principles remain the A principles, which is accountability, integrity, and responsiveness. What have we retained, Honorable Chairperson? I have already indicated. Now, what has changed? The only changes we have made is the values and our strategic objectives. Can we go to the strategic objectives? If you look at our strategic objectives as they were originally, they were accountability and accessibility and trust. The second one was prompt remedial action, and the last one, the third one was promoting good governance in all state affairs, and then we had an efficient and effective organization and open up, and then lastly we had optimal performance and service-focused culture. Now, our second strategic objective of an Honorable Chairperson is the only one that we've changed. It was because the tendency was to see prompt remedial action in terms of early resolution matters only. We wanted a clear understanding that every case deserves justice and deserves prompt justice. It doesn't mean that promptness only applies if it's an early resolution matter, and that promptness only applies if you're going to get remedial action. Even if you don't get remedial action, even if we make a finding that doesn't confirm your complaint, it still has to be done timelessly And so that's why we have changed that one. And as I have indicated, it was based on all of the feedback that we have received. Now, whilst the actual strategic objectives themselves have not changed much, except strategic objective number 2, the content there has been the strategies within the strategic objectives have been tweaked a little. I've already spoken about the first one, which is based on feedback from Parliament. We have relocated some of our regional offices, and we're negotiating and concluding agreements on customer service centers, and we're rolling up our mobile office. Now, let's go to the next one. We are also, as part of our accessibility strategy, we are going to launch in the next few days our social network pages, which will be Facebook, Twitter, Mixit, YouTube, and others. The primary group in this regard is young people. We do know, though, that professionals also use social pages a lot, but we are primarily targeting young people because we have noticed that young people have an interest in democracy as a dialogue, and on their own they do dialogue. But as they dialogue also, they are able to influence the rest of society to carry messages about this office. I know I had a young Korean person, a young guy who was about to be deported. Another young person told him, go to the public protector. He was going to be deported the following day. He'd been asked, please report at a particular place and pay this much money, a couple of thousands, and bring a ticket to Korea. And the other young person referred them to me and said, the public protector can assist you. And I requested Home Affairs to stay the deportation whilst we go through it. And we reviewed it and we found that the reason he was being deported is he signed the wrong form. He signed the form for pensioners. What is it? Question, why wasn't he asked to please submit the right form? But the young person was petrified at the time he came to the office. But the point I'm making there, honorable members, is that's why we're also looking at this particular group, that it can carry the message and can enrich others beyond young people. We're also looking at volunteers. We've had a lot of people asking, why don't you use us to collect complaints and to tell people about the office? We are planning to establish a regional office in Limpopo, and we have developed a comprehensive stakeholder engagement plan that is looking at rolling out our engagements to stakeholders. Under prompt justice, including remedial action, it's no longer prompt remedial action, it's prompt justice, including remedial action. The key focus there, as I have indicated, honorable members, is to use more ADR. As I've said, it works faster and it gives people justice immediately. But more importantly, one of the things I found in the cases that I've personally mediated and I've heard from the DPP that it's the same, is that when people look each other in the face and see each other's pain, it just works faster. And it doesn't become a statistic, it doesn't become a theoretical question. It becomes a real person sitting over there saying, because of your administrative action, this is where I'm sitting in society at the moment. Had you acted differently, I would be in a different position. I have seen a shift in the thinking in the room and people being more eager to move and do the right thing than when we write a whole lot of documents about what's wrong and what needs to be fixed. So that's why we're moving towards that. Later we'll be talking about asking for a new building, though, a state-owned one, so that we can be able to do more of the, to have more space for mediation, because everyone is doing it. And we also have introduced peer review of complaints to ensure quality of resolution of complaints. We used to do peer review only of the reports, but we're now looking at peer review of some of the complaints as well, including the ones that are mediated, so that people can just talk about how have we assessed the issues, what laws are applicable in other policies, and what benchmarks can we tap into. And that improves the quality of our work. We're also looking at increasing the number of systemic and own initiative in investigations. At the level of systemic, we have changed, if you look at the strategy, we've changed in such a way that we're not only looking at systemic investigations, we're also looking at systemic interventions. A systemic intervention is something like what we did in the Palestine, if you're familiar with the Palestine. Instead of only just doing our own investigation on our own and working away and then giving them a thick report on what they need to do, we work with them to fix, to identify some of the problem and build capacity and help them to fix some of the problems as we go along with the research, with the investigation. We've done that, for example, again in Bramfisherville, where we found really a serious situation of spillage of sewage there. Again, we didn't go there on our own, we brought in them. We brought in our own additional engineers, we brought in our own environmental experts to assist there in identifying the systemic problem, so that there was a assistance to them in fixing the problem, whilst at the end of the day we still had to do our systemic investigation into what went wrong in terms of how the place was designed, how procurement was done, from who, how quality assurance and payment. So we're doing the more maladministration part, and then also doing a systemic solution with them. We've taken the same approach at NALA. As soon as we went there to look at the program, I engaged in dialogue with the acting, with the caretaker person there, to look at how do we make sure that things are fixed, and my team is working with him to look at how do we make sure things are fixed. Part of our systemic intervention as well is to improve communication between organs of state and the communities, which is really part of our role, really, as an ombudsman, is to ensure that we repair the damaged relationship between organs of state and the people. Operationally, some of the things that have changed are the following. Our business model is being reviewed, and we are streamlining our processes. We must say here we're being assisted by one organ of state, and we're also working with a civil society agency to assist us to look at streamlining our business processes. Utilize, for example, we want to utilize the intake and assessment more, so that there's a better assessment of the issues in a case and determination of an investigation strategy right up front, so that an investigator is not left alone and then they make mistakes and then we try to fix them later. That is one of the things that we're doing. And we will be centralizing a lot more of the intake and assessment, and we are considering cancelling, for example, other ways of accessing that. You know, right now people can write to me if they want, they can write to so and so, and things are beginning, now that cases are too many, things are beginning to disappear in the system. Sometimes it takes a few days to track a case because there are multiple entry points, so we want to have a single entry point. If obviously people want me to pay attention to it, rather they copy me instead of coming through me. So it all goes into one point. That point distributes it to all of us so that we know what came in on the same day, and then we fix it. But we'll still make sure that we're accessible. Like walk-ins will still be maintained, but faxes we will get rid of and use more of the electronic, and then maybe two ways electronic. And so that's something that we're looking at now. We may then have to shift some of our investigators between units, because some of the work is going to be administrative rather than investigative work. We also bring in different skills. At the moment, our investigation capacity is mainly lawyers, Honorable Chairperson. We have, through working with our the business partners that are assisting us, we have decided that we will bring in an engineer at the level of assisting us with designing the system, because we have a system, a complaint system, that makes sure that there are no cracks in the system, a bolt to last system. So we've been advised and we've accepted that we'll bring in engineers, but we'll start with only one, just to assist us at the level of a case management system throughout. We've also decided to bring in a data analyst, because of some of the work we do around forensic investigations. And we're looking at also splitting the team of investigators going forward between lawyers and non-lawyers. You will agree with me, Chairperson, that when we're looking at whether a hospital did something wrong or didn't do anything wrong when a young girl lost a leg, a lawyer is not going to help you much about that. A lawyer will talk about what went wrong with the law, but when you're looking at what exactly should the hospital have done, we had that case, actually, I'm talking about a real-life case, where we had to go back now to the medical, to the health council and said, assist us to review this, to find out whether really there was maladministration. We had our own view as lawyers, but we still needed a doctor's perspective on that matter. So we're thinking of things like that. Accountants, if you do analysis of bank statements, for example, telephone records, things are often coded, so you need people. Of course, we're not going to bring an army of experts. Some of it you can always insource per case, but we just want a core of some of the core skills that we're going to get. That's part of reviewing our operations. We're also reviewing our information technology, and we want to report to this parliament, but finally we have a solution to our CMS. After going backwards and forward, we now know what went wrong with the problem, and we are being assisted to sort it out. Changes at the level of, the last important thing that I would like you to note, Honorable Chairperson, which will have major impact in the way we do business, and again in streamlining our cases, is a call center. At the moment we have a one-person call center. And that call center person just passes messages to investigators. So beyond an investigator busy dealing with a very complex case, they have to do call center duty as well, where cases are forwarded to them. Whilst they're in the middle of trying to write a complex report, they have to listen to a complainant and take a statement. That's the system we have at the moment. We want to separate that so that the ones that do investigations, they focus on that, they give their attention to it, and then a group that sits at the call center does receive calls and then early resolution at the call center, and they don't investigate. So that has already started that work. A lot of work has happened in the past year, and a seed funding is provided in this budget that we're presenting to you, Honorable Chairperson, but we will talk about additional money for the call center later, sir. Changes at the level of people. We have gone through a slightly painful process of reviewing our performance management system. It wasn't totally in sync with the objectives. For example, one of the key difficulties was rewarding numbers without looking at what really happened. For example, if I disposed of a whole lot of cases without looking at whether there was justice at the end of the channel, and also without looking at the quality of the investigations and the speed at which all of the cases were done. So I would have done a good number in terms of some of the cases, but some of them I can drag for 3 years. There are no consequences because the ones I reported on were fine. So we've looked at that and we're working as a team. The advice we got, which has really worked, was perhaps instead of just rushing to try and begin to punish those that are not delivering according to our service promise, let's start at building a common value system and a common approach to a purpose-driven organization. That's how we've moved. So we backtracked a bit, and then as a second step to this, say, if we're going to be a purpose-driven organization, how do we then measure our successes? How do we reward those that deliver according to the service progress? Because as the organization gets more profiled, people expect justice and they expect quality service everywhere, not some of the places. But also, Honorable Chairperson, this strategy also has provided for review of conditions of service for staff, because staff retention is essential. We still feel that the OSD regime we're on is inappropriate for the skills we have. And as a result, there's a glass ceiling at the top. People stay because they see the job as a calling, the ones at the top. But a lot of the young ones that are coming in, they get the skills, and they exit when they find more money. So we would like to, but even the ones that are staying because it's a calling, we believe that they deserve more. So it's something that we've been discussing with Treasury, and we will require your support in this regard. It also allows us to not turn good investigators into managers, Honorable Chairperson. You can have a highly paid investigator that is not a manager, and then you retain them because that's what they do best. Right. Now, what are the challenges, Honourable Members? Just quickly, our greatest challenge is still the fact that our average workload per investigator is 254 complaints per year. Now, for a call centre, that makes sense. For an investigating organization, no, it doesn't make sense, because the investigators have to be able to find information beyond what is officially provided, which is investigation. But more importantly, to study the law and be the ones making a determination on what should have happened. Because unlike magistrates, we don't depend on lawyers to bring heads of arguments and then say these are the legal principles applicable. We have to do that. We don't depend on policemen providing an investigation. You've got to do that yourself. So for our people to do this, Honorable Chairperson, we need to reduce the workload tremendously. And we thank Parliament, we thank Treasury for the fact that we got about 24 additional investigators last year. That made a huge difference. We're able to attract a crop of young, talented people at senior investigator level, but we need more. We really do. In terms of accessibility, we've become more accessible, but 20,000 complaints per year is still not reasonable in some of the provinces. Look at KZN, for example. KZN is a huge province. When we go there for outreach, there's numerous complaints, but we're only attracting about 1,000 complaints per year. So that is not commensurate with the needs of the people in that province. And so that's a challenge for us, but we're hoping that with our increased mob services and redirecting of resources and leveraging stakeholder relations, we can reach more and get those complaints, because we know they are complaints. Obviously, we don't want to invent complaints, but where they are, we really think that. Another challenge is the increase in complexity of our investigations. The Chief Executive Officer is going to talk very briefly, Honourable Chairperson, about what have we budgeted for. But for me, the key budget drivers are staff, which is investigators. When we got money from Treasury last year for additional money, we took it straight into people. We didn't use it for anything else. It was just additional people, not any other people, just only investigators that we budgeted. So that's our key budget. But as we are moving into becoming a more fully-fledged investigation unit, at level of service delivery investigations and the good governance and integrity ones, there's more field work that becomes a cost driver as well, because people are beginning then to need to drive to go to places to interview people and find additional information. That's another cost drive. But obviously the other normal cost drivers is the ones you would know, our lease, honorable Catherine, we did find out where the money was still as well in terms of our leasing. It was Western Cape, because it's very expensive to rent in this province, and Mpumalanga we found that also was one of the ones. And going forward, what we are requesting though is as part of a broader infrastructural plan of government, perhaps there should be centres for the Chapter 9s. I mean, it can be like a 5-year or 10-year plan, and then we can be part of that precinct. We're happy to be that. At national, our list is ending in 2014, and our preference would have been to move to a building that is bought for us or built for us, because that would probably be cheaper, but we don't know how is that possible, whether that would be possible, because it's only 2 years from now. It's just that buying, honestly, in the long term is cheaper. If you're going to have that institution for a long time, it's much cheaper to have it bought. So that's what we picked up in terms of where does most of the money come from. You will notice, Honourable Chairperson, that some of the budget items in terms of provinces, it looks like we're spending less. We're still working to change our budget in such a way that it shows exactly how much is spent at a province. Sometimes items show that the money is spent at national, whereas it's not spent, it's controlled at national, but it's spent to buy for things that are happening, to buy for goods and services that are happening at a province. So at the moment, it's something that we're going to work. I forgot, Honourable Chairperson, to introduce our team. So perhaps when I finish here, I'll introduce our team so that I can also introduce our CFO. Safe to say, that was another area that we picked up as a witness, our financial team. So we do have a new CEO, which I'm going to introduce. The CEO is going to talk to the budget. From my side, I just want to then go quickly to our special request. One is to the committee to request National Treasury to find the office in the following areas. Firstly, again, increase investigation capacity. As I said, we've got 24 more investigators, and we were extremely grateful for that. Our call center, we would like to have it as a fully-fledged call center. Our seed funding does not allow us to make it a fully-fledged call center. We know we've always had a toll-free line, but it has one person, so it's not functioning as a call center. The one person is also the switchboard operator. And then we are looking for funding for an integrated information technology and communication system. That system is looking at having conference facilities so that we don't bring our province people to national. We should be able to have video conferencing, which almost everyone has these days. It's not only for our meetings, Honorable Chairperson, it's also for training. We have training that is scheduled to take place on the 8th of May. The others are going to be joining us by telephone, which really is going to be difficult, like listening to the radio for them. So with video conferencing, we hope that every time we have training sessions and key meetings, we can join our people. But our integrated information technology and communication system covers more than that. Our updating our HR, updating our financial systems, and integrating everything. We are looking at also having fully-fledged mediation rooms. At the moment, we don't have, because the office was built for consultation rooms, not for mediation rooms, where there are often slightly big groups of people. And I've already indicated that new offices would really appreciate support for new offices and remuneration, review of remuneration for our staff, particularly OSD, which is occupation-specific dispensation. We also would appreciate an opportunity to present to you special reports on a quarterly basis so that we can pick up where Obanzo State are stifling progress by not giving us answers on time, leading to people coming to protest at our offices. And but just generally it undermines democracy, it undermines peace when that doesn't happen. We would like to report regularly on things like that. And we also would appreciate if the process of reviewing the Deputy Public Protector's package could be facilitated. Lastly, thank you. I would like to thank you, Chairperson, for the support, leadership, and the accountability you have placed my office under, to thank this committee for the support and accountability, to thank Parliament as a whole, particularly the Office of the Speaker, for the support we have received, to thank the people for the support we get, the feedback we get, and the utilization of our services, organs of state, especially those that comply with our investigations and remedial action, the media for keeping the dialogue going, because we're not a court of law, we don't depend on the sheriff implementing our findings, we depend on democracy as a dialogue, and moral suasion coming from that dialogue. We thank them, and we thank fellow oversight agencies with whom we have collaborated when we have dealt with some of these matters. We will continue to focus on good time, good quality, and a good time in terms of handling of investigations, making a lasting impact on good governance and the rule of law, as well as contribution to human rights, even though we are not necessarily a human rights commission. And it's important to us that we keep our promises, so that we can strengthen democracy and we can strengthen your role as Parliament. Thank you. See you all. Just the team is the Chief Executive Officer, Mr. Themba Mthethwa, Ms. Matlo Sibokodi, the new Chief Financial Officer, Deputy Public Protector, whom you know, Advocate Mami Kishai, Ms. Bonagelo Mokgaladi, our strategy, head of strategy, Ms. Kgalalelo Masidi, the spokesperson, Mr. Risenga Maruma, who is basically the chief of staff in my office, the official tag being called senior manager executive support. Yes. And sitting right at the back there is a advocate, Rotsen Janse van Rensberg, who is the head public protector representative heading the Western Cape province. Thank you.
Thank you very much, public protector. All right.
Thank you. Deputy Public Protector, Chairperson, and Honourable Members. This is just a quick presentation on the MTF allocation for the Public Protector for the next three financial years. For the 2012-2013, we've seen an increase of 12%, which put us at 174 million. For the 2013-2014, 190, 2014-15, 205. You'll recall that there has been an increase of 12 because of the amount that we got for the once-off investigators, investigation to clear, but it's better off than it was in 2009 when we're just above 100 million as well. This is the description in terms of the personal budget and the goods and services as well. Through the MTF 2012-2013, 2013-2014, and then 2014-2016, with the percentage increase in respect of each budget personnel for each financial year, goods and services for each financial year as well. This is the graphic presentation as well of the MTF allocation, similar to the previous one, but now having separated it from the personal budget to that of the goods and services. This is the budget we have for this financial year per programs. We have three programs, the strategic direction and executive support, which basically comprises about 13%, the cooperation of taking the lion's share of the budget at 47%, and the corporate services at 39%, all in all coming to 174 million that we have for this financial year. This is the pie in terms of the corporate services as well, cooperations, and the strategic direction, how it is being split. This is the budget that we have separated in respect of the strategic objective, how much we're spending in respect of each strategic objective. Obviously, that's from justice and remedial action, not from remedial action only, 18%. The efficiency of the organization taking the lion's share in respect of the streamlining of our business processes as well, and the IT, of course, the call center and so forth. This is the, again, the graphic presentation as per pie now in respect of the allocation in respect of each strategic objective. This is the entire budget allocation, including personnel, goods and services, contingencies, and capital costs. Again, this is the graphic presentation now, where you'll see that the biggest chunk will definitely go to personnel, 65%, 30% to goods and services, and then 3% to contingencies, and 2% to capital. This is the most important thing for us, at least, to see how much we spend the entire budget. Basically, based on this financial budget, it means the Treasury or the government of South Africa just spent about 3.44 rand per person in South Africa to the Public Protector as well. This is the budget allocation per case, and of course that has been allocated in the. This is the budget allocation per province as well. Mpumalanga at 990, Gauteng, of course, at 990, which is basically 13%. The Public Protector did touch on this. That is something that we're looking at, streamlining on the amount we spend per province, based on the number of people and the cases we're receiving at the province, which will be aligned and be addressed through the implementation of the new strategic plan that we have, including the relocation of offices that has been mentioned, particularly the Northwest and the Northern Cape, that we're going to be correcting as per the strategy that we have. Yes, this is basically the graphic presentation again per province, basically indicating that Mpumalanga and Gauteng, of course, are the biggest, with the Free State, based on the population there, having the least of the budget. Thank you. That was just the budget allocation. Thanks.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. I think the only thing I can also say is that the executive support budget is misleading, because the Deputy Public Protector and I are functionaries as well. Because of the nature of the office, we investigate, and whilst we provide strategic support, we are also the chief investigators in the office.
Maybe if I may add, Chair, on what the public press just mentioned earlier on regarding the case management system that we have and the address that we have. We're working closely with the Treasurer now and the CETA. We ask SARS to assist us to see what the problem is. We've identified the problem, and we are busy following proper procurement processes to address the plan is there to make sure that all the woes that we have in the case management system, including the call center, will be addressed probably by the mid-May or so. We're just waiting for the CETA as well as the Treasury to give us a go-ahead. The CETA is the state agency information. I know, Chair, you're shaking your hand, but we are obliged in terms of the law to go to them. We don't have a chance. Otherwise, as an integrity organization like the public protector, we have to work through them and follow the law as it stands.
Honourable members, Dean Smuts, followed by Prof. Ndabandaba, followed by Giselle Adams, followed by Panama Jake, followed by Steve Swart. Did I see you? Yes. In that order, please.
Thank you, Chair. My first question was precisely going to relate to the electronic systems which have now just been discussed. You said that someone had at long last discovered for you what the problem was with the case management system. I was just glancing through our July 2007 Chapter 9 review at our findings then on the public protector, and particularly difficulties with data and an absence of case management system were then noted. And I was going to congratulate you, based on what I read in this excellent little book, on having progressed. But it seems you have not progressed that far. May we ask, out of curiosity, what was the essential problem with the case management system that was diagnosed? And then secondly, I must now deduce that in fact you don't have a new system up and running yet, right? It's because our reaction on CETA is because we have spent some time with justice and also to a lesser extent with the NPA. You will know that the 7-point plan that was postulated also in 2007 as a solution for the difficulties with crime and crime management in this country has yet to be implemented, because although justice did a little bit of work, prisons and the NPA had done this, they now have done something. And it is just our experience with our other portfolio organisations that there are difficulties with CETA, which gives very, very, very slow networks, for one thing. So stay in touch with us, perhaps when you come for the quarterly clear, and if you've encountered difficulties, talk to us about that. Secondly, you make the statement in your introduction, Public Protector, to this strategic plan, that if your recommendations are not implemented, the public protector becomes a gate to nowhere, a memorable phrase. Now, just give us an indication, and it may be here, I may have missed it. Advocate Moswana, when he was the public protector, told us in the Chapter 9 review, and I can't find it, but I'm sure memory says, that in fact his recommendations were, the majority, but his recommendations were implemented. Do you encounter difficulties in that respect? And would you have any statistics? In particular, I mean, clearly what one is trying to establish is whether the executive branch, where the government is working with you. I'm surprised, for example, to hear that there is any resistance from the GCIS to you using the facilities at the Tusong centres. I mean, it is self-evidently the place where your presence and services ought to be advertised. I can't see why, for example, you can't have a desk or an office in every Tusong centre. Why aren't they cooperating? Now, I'm very interested in the fact that you now describe what one would always have understood as remedial or conciliation work, which after all is the constitutional brief of yourselves and the Human Rights Commission's conciliation, mediation, in your case, remedial action. Now, it's interesting to note that you use now the term ADR, Alternative Dispute Resolution, which is something increasingly that we're all looking to in the civil justice system. To resolve cases and the caseload there. Why particularly do you call it ADR? Isn't it just old-fashioned mediation and conciliation? I listened with enormous interest how you recounted a minute or so ago how when you put people around a table together and they look at each other and they can see the emotional experience involved, matters do get resolved. Maybe that is the in the best new South African tradition. But that is not really in any sense different from mediation and conciliation, is it? So just some more light perhaps on the subject of why you are choosing to call it alternative mediation. And part of the other side of the same coin, you say that this, in your strategic plan that there is some stakeholder misunderstanding about remedial action. What does that mean? Is it that people think you can give binding orders, which of course you cannot? So please talk to us about that a little bit. And just lastly, and this is therefore a fifth question, do you think that we should charge Minister Bladen Zimande with insulting the public protector? I refer to the fact that it is an offence to insult the public protector, punishable by 40,000 or 12 months in jail under your act, and that he is quoted as having said, quoted Monday, April 23, in a remark to journalists at a dinner, the Chapter 9s, including yours, were being used by opposition forces and Polokwane grievers trying to run the country from the grave. He was quoted as saying, though, Madonsela had been quick to investigate complaints against ministers. She had dragged her feet in other cases. I don't want to be seen to be read in a negative way, he said. I support the public protector. I think the public protector is very important. So she does go into issues, but there is glaring selectivity, unquote. Do you think that that constitutes an insult, and do you think that we should take any action about it?
Okay, Prof. Ndabandaba.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I find it relevant that the Public Protector's Office has decided to bring in specialists like engineers, without suggesting that you bring in a whole army of specialists. Don't you think a social worker well trained in casework will also be relevant?
I want to ask a few questions based on the presentation that we received, but unfortunately the presentation is not numbered, so it might take a little bit long to get to where I basically want to get. Under achievements there's a bullet of just the first page of achievements. There's a first bullet that starts with, we managed to investigate 26,440 complaints. But then I want to go to the last page of achievements. Yes, that one. The last bullet, reduction in number of cases. My question is, how many cases are older than a year? I don't know whether it's got to do, maybe there's 9,539 cases that were mentioned earlier, but how many cases are older than a year, and were any progress made regarding these specific cases? In other words, if you give a specific number, are those still numbers that were just carried over, and were they in fact specific progress made to those cases? My next question is under the part that says what has really changed. It's point number two, the feedback from stakeholder consultations. You say bullet A. You've included the following strategies: focus attention to reasonable accommodation of persons with disabilities. Isn't people with disabilities normally the minority in the community? And would it not have been better if the focus was rather to make sure that all offices are accessible to people with disabilities, instead of focusing attention to reasonable accommodation of persons with disabilities? Then my last question has got to do with the budget and the allocation to the different provinces. This has been raised even last year, where focus should rather be placed on the population per province. And I see that in the Western Cape, the Western Cape is receiving much less money than Mpumalanga, Northwest, as well as the Free State. How long is it going to take before this is addressed? Thank you.
Okay. The Honourable Kunama Jack.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks to the Public Protector for the
presentation of the report. My question is about the suggested performance management system and conditions of employment and salary reviews. Ask if this is just going to be new, or you will actually be improving on the old system. And in terms of your previous systems, did you find your system working? And I'm actually asking this question in the background of what is in your strategic plan on page 21, that indicates part of the weakness is this low staff morale. You didn't actually talk about it much more. Maybe if you can indicate if this is connected. I also am interested in knowing that in terms of the request for a new building, do you have anything in mind? Because you're actually requesting support in terms of having a new building, but you don't give us an idea of what you want. Whether you've made some kind of investigation around this, and the financial implications in terms of what you want for the future. You've indicated, of course, that it may be cost-effective to buy a building rather than maybe continue to lease. But in terms of buying, we don't have an idea of what you've got in mind, how much it's going to cost, and how the money might probably be sold. Do you do vetting of your staff? That's the question I want to ask you, especially maybe senior management when they come on board. And then in terms of information communications technology, you've indicated that you need this in order for you to be in the position to do teleconferencing, which will be a system that will actually help to connect offices throughout the provinces. It will be cost effective indeed. But also, what I want to find out in this regard is whether you do have a system that can electronically register cases, because that can actually be something that can help to improve the services
for the Office of the Public Protector. Can you comment also about your structure? At the end, you mentioned something about the Deputy Public Protector salary, but you haven't actually indicated also the structure. I think I want to just be clarified on that as to how this works. My last question is about turnaround time in terms of the cases that I actually reported to the Office of the Public Protector. How long do you take to respond to a complaint? And I'm actually asking this because there has been some experience as to some of the cases that, you know, takes a year before you hear anything from the Office of the Public Protector. Is it something that is normal, and what percentage of such cases you have? All right. The very, very last one also, it's about partnerships. When we had our hearing with the Department of Justice, they've actually, and I'm mentioning partnerships that you made reference to that has got to do with civil society. The Department of Justice has indicated that they are interested in resuscitating the advice offices. And I'd like to know whether you think that advice offices can actually be offices that may help to promote the work of the public protector, and how you think you may possibly benefit from such advice offices that are actually established throughout the countries, especially in remote rural areas. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Firstly, my apologies for being late. I was at the Finance Committee, Public Protector, no disrespect intended. Just firstly, our commendations for the Strat Plan and for the performance of the Public Protector. Well done, particularly on the unqualified audit previously, and keep up that in particular when it comes to your finances. I'd like to pose a few questions on your cooperation with the executive, and if you covered it in your presentation, please, my apologies, you can just say you've covered it already. In previous presentations, there were indications of a difficulty in having your recommendations complied with by state departments. Is that still a problem? We also understand that there have been protocols approved with certain organs of state, which you indicated previously have resulted in an improvement of your working relationship and their responses to complaints, but how effective have those protocols been? And then we've got the Chapter 9 office in the Speaker's, the Chapter 9 unit in the Speaker's office. Has that been helpful in your relationship with Parliament and your relationship with state departments? How often have you met with them? And that was a very good idea, but we'd just like to know how efficient is that office. I'd also like to ask you a follow-up question to my colleague, Ms. Smuts. The Institution of Criminal Offence for insulting the Office of the Public Protector. Have you ever done that? Have you ever considered doing that? I don't think so, but I'd be interested to hear from you whether you have, it's ever been considered in general terms. And then you've got a very interesting your mandate, as we know, is set out in the Constitution, but you've also got your statutory mandate area set out on page 9 of your strategic plan, which covers a vast numbers of pieces of legislation. And I was quite interested to see the different aspects which you cover as your mandate. And my question is, I know you've got a huge amount of work, but there have been areas, and we know corruption is very widespread in South Africa. Have you ever thought of proposals to amend pieces of legislation to improve your work, seeing that you have mandate, such as the Protected Disclosures Act? There have been many concerns around the extent of that protection, and that might be something to consider. Number 5, you referred to the Protected Disclosures Act. We passed the Prevention and Combating of Corrupt Activities way back in 2004. Is there ways that we could improve that legislation that would help us in combating maladministration, abuse of power, which is part of your mandate? And then I also see that you've got a mandate is also the Special Investigating Unit. I'm interested as to what your mandate is there and your relationship with the SIU unit.
when one thinks of the police lease investigation, there was a close cooperation between you and the SIU, which we commend and we think can be built on. Just if you could comment on that aspect. Thank you, Chair.
Mr. John Jeffrey has submitted a prior apology for leaving the meeting early. He has responsibilities with regard to the presidency.
Jeff, sorry, I have one small question.
All right.
I omitted just to ask you that the estimated expenditure reports on the success, the E&E reports on the successful implementation of your ADR processes resolving complaints. And when one reads the E&E for 2012, one would have expected then that the number of complaints that get finalized by investigators would be increased. And one would then think that the number of finalized investigations per investigator should not increase. Is that correct? And are you finding that the ADR process is working well enough to decrease the amount of outstanding work that investigators are dealing with? Because the question then, direct question is, why is it then that the number of finalized investigations per investigator is not increasing if you're making use of the ADR process? And that just comes out of the indicators in the E&E. Maybe you could comment on that. Thank you.
All right. Public Protector, one from me, if I may, honorable members. Are you prepared to, or are you in a position to respond to the Richard Mdluli matter?
Thank you. Perhaps, Honourable Chairperson, I am going to start with the last one, but firstly, my sincere gratitude to Honourable Members for both the feedback and questions as well as the positive observations on some of our achievements. We really appreciate it. Honourable Chairperson, the first question I would answer is the question you've asked about can I comment on the investigation into the head of crime intelligence. I was going to announce this afternoon, but I can announce now then, if that's what you would want me to do, Honourable Chairperson. We were requested by two organizations, two complainants, to investigate this matter. The one complainant was the Honourable Kula Barnard, who is a member of this parliament. And the second complainant was the FW de Klerk Foundation. We have been requested to investigate several allegations of maladministration that include all of them are centering around the use of funds by the crime intelligence. I firstly indicated that I was going to do an assessment of this matter to look at whether it does fall into my jurisdiction as public protector, which my team and I promptly did. We did investigate, we did an assessment, we found that it does fall under my jurisdiction because the public protector's jurisdiction is any alleged improper conduct in state affairs or alleged or suspected improper conduct in state affairs. The second thing is the Public Protector Act says we can investigate any allegations of maladministration, improper prejudice, abuse of power, and abuse of state resources. And the Constitution says the only matters that are excluded from the Public Protector are decisions of courts. The Public Protector Act expands that to say, and not only decisions of courts are excluded from the Public Protector Act, but judicial matters are also included, which is broader than decisions of court excluded. But our understanding then means all administrative acts of the state fall within the jurisdiction. So we were able to make that decision. After that, I then indicated that I was going to conduct a preliminary investigation into this matter. We did conduct a preliminary investigation, and we would advise that at this stage I have decided not to proceed with a full investigation. My reason for deciding not to proceed with an investigation is that during the preliminary investigation, it included a meeting with the Inspector General of Intelligence. In my meeting with her, she indicated to me that she had not concluded her investigation into this matter. She is still investigating. So what I have then arranged with her, we just have to agree on timelines, is let her conclude her process, and then I get a sense from her report what are her findings and whether she has covered all of the matters that are alleged, and I will share with her then all of the information that I have on my side. And what we do when we refer matters, we then take a watching brief to then look at whether if that investigation has covered all bases and the remedies are equivalent to the remedies the public protector would have used. We will leave it at that then for now. And at the conclusion of that process, then we'll be able to say, where do we go from here?
Would you be able to have insight into all your findings, Jeff?
Will not some of her material be confidential? Will you have insight?
Between us, I will have insight into all her findings, because it's really different to one institution so that she can cover all bases. And if I can't have insight, then there would be no point in deferring to her jurisdiction for now. Yes. Honorable Chairperson, that's all I have to say on that matter.
Will you consider including the Office of the Auditor General as part of the team?
Honorable Chairperson, I hadn't really included that because it's not going to be a joint investigation for now. When I was informed by her that she is still doing the investigation, my approach was let her do the job to the best of her ability, but share information about everything that is being alleged from my side so that she doesn't do her part and then I'm left with aspects of the investigation that haven't been dealt with. But Honorable Chairperson, I can indicate to her if she deems appropriate that she could also involve the team from the Auditor General. I don't think she would object to that, but that would be a suggestion, Honorable Chairperson, take into account her duty to be independent, impartial, and accountable only to subject only to the Constitution and the laws.
The issue raised by Dean Smuts is shared by me, and it relates to classified information, which the Inspector General would be the only person having access to. And so there is that concern that we're worried about. But, all right, fine, we hear what you're saying. And without preempting anything, let's see how it goes. Suffice to say, we want to say to you, please don't hesitate to call on us if you come across that as a stumbling block, which I expect you will at some point.
Thank you, Chairperson. But in terms of the law, I shouldn't, but I'm glad and I'm so grateful that Parliament is giving me that opportunity, because since the new law is not operational yet, or the proposed Protection of State Information Act is not law yet, I shouldn't be prevented, because in terms of the current situation, I should not be prevented. In terms of the law, in terms of PDA and my own act, I'm allowed to ask to subpoena any information from anyone in the Republic. No one is excluded from my ability to subpoena information from anyone in the Republic. But if should there be resistance, I think, yes, rather than involving a court of law, I'm more grateful to come back to you, sir.
May I say, I think a lot of us will be disappointed that you can't conduct a full-out investigation now. But as you say correctly, nothing that is now classified in South Africa is constitutionally classified. Any of it, if anybody tried to resist access to you, any of it would crash in court. And therefore, I applaud your comments on the fact that you have the right to subpoena any information. I agree with you, nothing now classified is constitutionally classified. And please, whatever deference you feel you have to exercise, please be astute in insisting on your own powers should things not work out to your satisfaction. And as our chairperson says, we are here for you if things get difficult.
Chair, I might be slightly out of order, but just on the issue of the protection of the State Information Bill, the public protector made a very compelling submission to the NCOP process relating to the difficulties that you would experience should the bill be passed in its present form. And it's something that we need to just put on the back burner. It's not in our hands at the moment. It depends on what amendments the NCOP might consider. But should your requests not be considered favorably, clearly it has a huge impact that I, for one, never considered serving on that committee, and I think it's something that I might be out of order, Chair, but it's just something to put on the back burner, if I may.
I don't understand you either.
What do you say? Well, Chair, what I'm saying is the public protector indicated that as the bill is presently formulated, she will have great difficulty doing her work, and it is not something that we considered when we were dealing with the bill, and it is something that is now not in our hands, so we can't even deal with it now. But should the NCOP ad hoc committee not consider your requests for small amendments here and there that will deal with the problems that you raised, we might have to petition or take further action that is necessary. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, honourable members, and thank you. Thank you, honourable members, for the opportunity again to come to Parliament on the issue of classified information. Honourable Chairperson, I thought I understand Honourable Swart is that. My request was that the public protector, our Chapter 9 institutions, be given the same status that has been given to courts in terms of access to information. In fact, I've just returned from a trip in the USA where I found that even certain lawyers that have a certain level of clearance have access to classified information. Otherwise, how do you deal with corruption in the sale of state state assets within the intelligence services, within the army, etc.? So it's something that can be done, but with a certain level of integrity that is required. And that is the request that we made, so we're waiting for to be told what happens in that area.
Are you referring, ma'am, to the fact that under PIA, but a court of law under PIA Section 80, when there is an application for disclosure of information, a court of law can then take the what has been described as the judicial peak. Although it has provisions in Section 80 PIA which are problematic, which says that the judge may not divulge that information. So it's a judicial peak. And is that what you have in mind for the public protector? Then I have a problem, because it's not that anybody... it's still a court of law taking the judicial peak on information refused under PIA. Is that what you're referring to?
No, Honourable Chairperson, I think what I was referring to is, Honourable Member, in terms of the current Protection of State Information Act, there's a whole chapter that is given to courts about information in their hands, that's Section 12. So my request was there should be a chapter that looks at access to relevant information in the hands of Chapter 9 and access to information. PIA, as it stands at the moment, the public protector is one of the institutions, actually, that is given the duty to resolve disputes. in terms of access to information. In terms of the Protected Disclosures Act, the public protector is one of only two institutions that can take protected disclosures that are specified in the Act, and then the Act makes provision for others. So the request we've made is that the public protector be not treated in the same way as institutions that are not responsible for enforcement of the Constitution. Because we are responsible for enforcement of the Constitution, but non-judicial enforcement thereof. Yes.
Chair, just a last note, because this is possibly not the place and time, but it is of such public interest. We are creating an information regulator under the other information bill, the Protection of Personal Information Bill, which is the Justice Bill. We are creating a regulator. That regulator, we are just still in dispute amongst ourselves about how we're writing those powers. That regulator will have a committee led by a judge or similarly legally eminent person. That committee, which will be called the Enforcement Committee, will have the same Section 80 powers, in other words, will be able to have insight into even classified material. But we are, in other words, creating an architecture for the information regulator, including a judicially qualified, independent, within that architecture, committee, which will have those powers of taking the judicial peaks. And I would argue, we'll talk again another day, but I would argue that you need at minimum that entire architecture before you give to what is in this case not a Chapter 9 institution but an independent body, before you give the powers of taking a judicial peak. It's got a judicial peak has to be formed by a judicial person.
Well, I'm not arguing, honourable members, for a judicial peak. I'm arguing for a Chapter 9 peak. I think my whole presentation to Parliament was a recognition of Chapter 9 in its own sense as a Chapter 9, which is an ombudsman institution currently, in terms of the Constitution, having powers to look at everything and to deal with disputes involving state affairs. It doesn't have to do that through the judiciary, which is what now the Protection of State Information Act requires it to do, and so my argument was that it, but I agree with you, Honourable Member, that we can discuss it in a separate platform. But just talking about that thing of the PDA and PIA, I have indicated to Parliament and in other platforms that the Public Protector is very much happy to part with PIA powers under PIA, because PIA is a very important statute. So what we're not arguing for is not a peak in the enforcement of PIA, because that's a peak looking at it so that you can decide whether or not the dispute regarding access to information is a valid one. Ours, we're talking about access to information. If I have to resolve a particular matter, I'm doing an investigation. I don't want to go through any other structure, because the Constitution doesn't want me to do that right now. Wants me to call that information from anywhere. But I support the approach that is being taken.
Yes. Now, I think your line of thinking may very well be approved. Right. We'll do that under the umbrella of the Commission of State Information, I would think.
I think that's what Honourable Swart was talking about. Thank you. Right, Honourable Chairperson, I am going to go back to answer the questions that have been posed to me, starting with the Honourable Honourable Swart. Honourable Adams. Sorry, ma'am. Honourable Adams. You asked, Honourable Adams, you asked what is the problem with the with our case management system, and if... I'm sorry, that was Honourable Smart. Sorry, Honourable Smart, you asked what is the problem with that. Have we finally resolved it? Yes, Honourable Smart, it has said that... the most important step towards solving a problem is finally understanding what is the problem. Eventually we got to understand what was the problem. The problem, the system is called, is based on SAP, which almost everyone in this country, a whole lot of people use the SAT system, SAT system. And the system then, they appoint somebody that they call a development partner. The partner then is the people that are supposed to install the system. So the system is built, designed well, but the quality of the output of the system depends on who is the partner that implements it. Well, they call them implementing partner, not development partner, implementing partner. So we had an implementing partner that at the moment we finally discovered shortchanged us. The quality of the implementation did not take into account our business processes and the kind of outputs we wanted from the system. We wanted a case management system, and the system at that stage could pretty much store information and was not a system where we could really lock in information like how many cases we received. But a case management system, as one of the members have said, is a case management system that has to look at the total case file from checking just what cases came in, and then you check each case. If for example, you're asking me what is happening with investigation X, at the press of a button, I should be able to say the last action on this system happened on the 15th of February, and this is what we did, and then this is the next action. The system has never been able to do that. So it wasn't clear whose fault was it. Was it SAP? We thought from management it was said that we were sold something that doesn't work. We found now that the actual system works, but how the engineering, the softwaring of the system, you've got to program it according to your business processes, because it can give you what you have programmed based on your business processes. So we had lengthy discussions with SAP. We had the Auditor General audit it, not as an auditor, but now audit it in terms of design versus ability to deliver on what it's supposed to do. And they had problems. They also discovered that it can't deliver what it was supposed to do. And then we had discussions with SAP, we had discussions with SARS, because we're looking at people who also have systems in that they make them. We had discussions with the CCMA that had a very good system. We went to the UK, our counterpart, the Ombudsman of UK, we worked on their system, it was perfect. And so we knew what a good system should work like. Case tracking, being able to provide performance information to submit to you and to the Auditor General, all of those things. Now we've discovered that the system could do that. It just needs now a development, an implementation partner. It needs to be upgraded because our business needs have also improved. One of the flaws in the original design is that it didn't take into account also the fact that we're a multiple mandate institution. Like, we're a public protector based on the Public Protector Act, but we're also an executive ethics enforcer, PDA, and all of these others. So as we try to key in everything into something that was designed for something else, eventually it was overloaded. At some stage, it actually packed, and we had to go manual. To be able to service our people, we had to go manual. And that was quick thinking from the intake and assessment team to say, let's temporarily go manual so that there isn't suffering from the people and the system moves. So the reason it packed was it was finally overloaded in terms of its capacity, in terms of how it had been programmed then. Among other the fact that we're also moving from one, we're migrating from one network system to another. So those things crash. We migrated, yes, we did, honorable chairperson. But I think the good news is that we've now spoken to different people. We know that what we have now is going to work. We didn't want to go with any implementation partner without going through a tender process. And that's what the CEO was explaining, that even though we were then told that even SAP itself has cancelled out certain implementation partners that don't do service, good service to the product. Because obviously when you complain about SAP. You don't complain about the implementation partner. So the things, I personally, for example, being new to the system, I thought SAP doesn't work. That's what I had concluded. But you know, through this lengthy exercise, we then finally actually located the problem, and we're now moving. We had two options: to stay with SAC or to go with the CCMA system. And the corporate support team had to make decisions that were financially viable, because if we went with the CCMA system, we would have had to impair the system and write off 10 million. So we couldn't do that. So then they had to work out something where we can salvage part of that 10 million and still they'll be able to have a proper system that functions like any other proper electronic case management system. As you asked them about, do we have, oh, it was you, Honorable Macheke, do we have a case management system? We do, yes, right. And any resistance from GCIS? What's the percentage of cases, recommendations that are not implemented? They're not high, honorable, honorable smarts. Honorable smarts.
Everybody
is confused.
Smart.
And honorable smarts, I have no new sense pre-democracy, so I don't have an excuse to get confused. That's right. The percentage of reports. Honorable smart. My team and I insist on using the Constitution. So we stick with Section 182(1)(c) of the Constitution to say the percentage of remedial action, of appropriate remedial action that is not taken, is very, very limited. The concern is usually the time it takes, because then we have to dialogue to say, can you pick and choose? Can you cherry pick? And Honorable Smart has asked the question around, are our decisions binding or not? Our view is, perhaps, Honorable Smart, we should ask a different question, which is, what is the duty of an organ of state once I have pronounced in terms of my responsibility under Section 182(1)(c) of the Constitution, which requires me to take appropriate remedial action? And I've discussed it with academics, I've discussed it with people and said the drafters of our Constitution would have seen the provisions of the Ombudsman Office of the UK where it says recommend, but they chose the word take. And then the Public Protector Act talks about recommend as one of the options. It says I must make findings, I must make recommending, I could express a point of view, I could resolve through mediation, conciliation, negotiation, or any other means I deem appropriate. But the underlying point is I must resolve. So the view I take, Honourable Members, and you have to guide us here, is we think until the matter has been concluded in a matter where we can say it has ended, whether it ends against the complainant or in favour of the complainant, if it's not ended, if there's no action taken, it hasn't ended, it's not resolved. So that's my approach to the Constitution, is that if my finding is that the complainant was wronged, that's a finding. I am compelled by the Constitution to make that. I am empowered by the Public Protector to make that finding. Then the Public Protector says, well, after finding, I can then make these other things. But the view is so that the matter is resolved. If there's a piece of paper hanging in somebody's wardrobe or somebody, that's not resolved. That means I've expressed an opinion. Hence, Honorable Smarts, I talk about a gate to nowhere, when all I have is a piece of paper. And we took that case when we dealt with the victim of raped 48 times. And eventually the state agreed with us that until such matter that there has been some agreement on, if we agree that she was wronged, by the administrative acts of the state. And being wronged was that she was prejudiced or she suffered an injustice. What then? And our answer was that, what then? The next question is, how do we place her as close as possible to where she would have been if the state had acted properly in the first instance? We can't place her to where she's been. After one of the cases I'm going to release my report, I was going to release it today, but I think probably tomorrow, is a case where the family was totally devastated. And you can never, ever give them back what was taken away from them. You can never. But the point is really, it's restorative justice, is to say, how do we gently place you as close as possible to where you would have been? So if that family, for example, in this case, it's a different story because most of it was mediated and we all agreed in the end of what they deserve. But if all they had was a piece of paper that from the public protector that said you were wronged, could we say that's justice?
I think it's a very nuanced and intelligent way to approach it, because it stays with what really is in the Constitution and the law, but combined with the moral suasion which you do command, we will get the results. And I think it's a good way of interpreting it.
Thank you, Honourable Smith. Which really is the role of the Ombudsman, is to promote dialogue and a transformational approach to the engagement between the state and citizens. It's not coercive force. It's persuading the state about what's right, what is good administration, as opposed to maladministration, which is bad administration. Now, so yes, most of them are implemented, but the few that are not implemented or the ones that are delayed implementation, often the consequences on the complainant are serious, very serious. It's really small mistakes, but huge consequences. Small delays, devastating consequences. So that's why it matters to us that everyone understands that in terms of administrative justice, even if we're just a commission of inquiry, recommendations are by nature something that is a very serious process. The idea is that you should take them seriously. You should only deviate if you can prove unreasonableness. So, because otherwise, what is the point? Even if it was just a commission of inquiry that had recommended, but I actually think the drafters of our constitution gave us more than just the power to recommend. They didn't make us a court, but they didn't make us a gate to nowhere. They placed us at that particular gap between the courts and something else. Any resistance? Honourable Smart, I may have given an impression that we got resistance from GCIS. No, we didn't. In fact, we got cooperation from them. Initially, we were invited by the young journalists from GCIS to work with them, but we wanted to meet with them formally at an institutional level to say, how do we key into your outreach and reach more of our people? And we got absolute support to song access to their radio and various avenues to reach out to people, because there's one state, there's one people, and all of us are just trying to do our best to better the lives of those people. The use of ADR, you are right, Honourable Smarts. It's really the old conciliation, mediation, negotiation. But when we say ADR, it's just a short term for us for combining all of them. Because often the way we do it, the system we are developing is a system whereby we don't mediate like the CCMA, like that formalized, thing. Ours, it's really a facilitated dialogue between whoever feels wrong and the one who is supposed to have wronged the other. So it's not like hard and fast principles. So we do them in a combined way, and we are in the process of documenting it, and the DPP or the Deputy Public Protector has been working on documenting it, just based on our experiences and international benchmarks. The idea is an easy dialogue, but with some sense of obviously obeying rules around impartiality and us not taking sides in anything. But combination of mediation, conciliation, and so we don't. I personally don't like the use of alternative dispute resolution. I prefer appropriate dispute resolution because you then decide from these informal means which one is appropriate as opposed to it being an alternative. Others talk about it as I think some ombudsmen talk about approach. Some talk about a proportionate dispute resolution, but it's just all about picking. We will conciliate when we need to conciliate, mediate. Sometimes we negotiate. We take the parties outside, and then when we know what the law requires, we negotiate and say, listen, like if I'm talking about the case where I got the money from the old man, it wasn't your CCMA conciliation. It gets to a point where you ask the complainant, please go, I'll talk to them. And then you talk to them and say, I've listened to you. You make a good point, but the reality is, here's the deal.
Chair? Yeah, I think ADR is an alternative precisely to full adversarial court proceedings followed by a judgment.
Yes.
That's why it's called alternative dispute resolution. And that's precisely why I asked why you are using it in this context, because it's not, in fact, an alternative to a full process and judgment. But I like the idea of appropriate, etc. So we are talking still about mediation and conciliation.
Absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. Thank you, Honourable Swartz. Then the next question was, Okay, I've already answered the question about about remedial action, Honourable Chairperson. Then there was a question about contempt of the public protector. I'm not aware of a case where contempt of the public protector order was issued. I gather that the ombudsman institution tries to use soft power more than hard power. You have to resort to your hard power as a last resort. But I have indicated through my spokesperson that I will be writing a letter to the minister and asking him to kindly assist us with the evidence he has that we have been preparing a political part. The reason we're taking it seriously is that pronouncements by a minister have more weight than pronouncements by street persons, and I don't believe that a minister would willingly violate section 181(3) of the constitution, which requires other organs of state to support chapter 9 institution. We have also indicated that it is true that the minister's wife did lodge a complaint with us in February last year. We didn't ignore that complaint. That complaint came at a time when we were already involved in an investigation against SABC. So what has happened with the SABC investigation is that we've had what we call in our language issue creep, so issues that creep up as you investigate. So you have two choices when that happens, is that you can conclude the investigation that you're doing and pack these ones and then later start new investigations. Or if you think they are material to the issues that you are dealing with, you add them. In this particular case, they are material because we've been investigating issues of systemic governance failure, appointment problems, procurement problems. So when these things were added, then they went in, and then my specific investigation became a systemic investigation. So she brought a complaint, and then more recently, another group of staff members brought a complaint. So that has delayed the investigation because then all of these things keep being added. And obviously at some stage then we thought, okay, let's stop it here. So it's not true that we've ignored it. But there are delays in investigations, Honourable Chairperson, and it has to do, I did say initially that when investigators are doing complex investigations, usually they do so as a team, and two, they dedicate themselves to one investigation at a time. Because of our resource constraints, we can't do that. So you have an investigator who is involved in more than one, in a number of very complex investigations, and they do it because a lot of them, well, majority of team members are dedicated and they see this as a calling, so they work overtime, they work weekends to do this, but it's still the workload is more than we would need. Ideally we would want to be able to free someone's hands for the duration of a complex investigation, that they could focus on that, but it's not possible at the moment. Right.
Is the excellent Madame Nzimande still the chief people officer at the state broadcaster? I didn't even know that she was involved in this. It's Pumizile, isn't it?
The complainant in this particular case, Mrs. Nzimande, complained after she left SABC. She was no longer at SABC when she made the complaint. But just to say, we did not ignore the complaint. We never ignore any complaint from anyone. And Honorable Ndabandaba, thank you for the suggestion. It seems to me that because of the impact, the traumatic impact of some of the administrative actions on people, you're absolutely right that a social worker could assist to quantify that. The one last investigation that I did actually that involved a victim impact assessment, it was very helpful in that the lawyer, they had eventually involved a lawyer, and the lawyer was able to bring in, they brought in a psychologist who talked very clearly about what had happened, and it was really, really amazing, that kind of information, and how it made all of us, including the respondent institution, to understand the impact of this person. And it would help, obviously, if we had an inside person, even a social worker, to just make sense of what really the impact of some of our actions as people who exercise public power on ordinary people. To you, it's a small thing, but the huge consequences on the one individual are sometimes beyond repair. Honorable Sword, how many cases do we have this year that are older than a year? We said last year there were 400 and... At the end of 31st of March, there are 438. I've just asked the team to then say the previous year. Whilst the team works out, I'm going to get into that. So that because we're talking about that they had decreased, so we need a comparison between the previous year and Honourable. But they have decreased. But Honourable Ford, the Honourable Adams, you asked about those figures, about that 9,000. Those are cases that include cases that would have been lodged on the 31st of March itself. Because everything that was lodged that year then gets locked. Even cases that were lodged that week, they then become cases that we take over to the following year. The ones older than a year, we just mean those that are older than 12 months. That's the difference between those that are from the previous year and the ones that are older than the year. And so it's really one of our desires, Honorable Adams, it's one of our desires not to have cases that are older than a year. We shared at our strategic planning meeting that in Denmark the Ombudsman has to come and explain to Parliament why he or she has cases that are older than 5 months. The reason is because the Ombudsman are supposed to be an alternative to courts, provide a quick remedy to these devastating consequences of maladministration. And if it's going to take as long as going to court, why bother to go to the Ombudsman? And that's why then when state organs of state don't respond on time, it pains us, because if they don't respond on time, then we can't give a remedy to the complainant on time. In fact, there has been at least one instance where the person eventually found the remedy in a court of law, and then ours became an academic exercise. Whilst we're waiting for the minister, through a dear colleague later, the coercive power of a court brought justice. But the idea is that our soft power should bring justice without people, because those who don't have money anyway are not going to be able to go to court. So that's honorable agents is what we're trying to achieve by the other question many ask is, why are we focusing on disability? You are right, ma'am, but maybe I should just explain is that you are right about focusing on the community as a whole, but we are saying within that community as a whole, take into account diversity. Because at the moment, when we do our accessibility materials, for example, all of them assume people can see. Excuse me, and all of them, the ones that are audio, assume people can hear. So we have been talking then to these other constituencies about how do we diversify our accessibility. So that it was in that context that I was talking. When I talk about reasonable accommodation, for example, for people with disabilities, we're not talking about accommodation in terms of buildings. It's a concept. It's an equality concept that talks to providing reasonable arrangements that meet the needs of people with disabilities. So reasonable accommodation might mean our business cards should have a braille version. Our materials should also be in audio. Our annual report should be in audio. Our reports should be in audio. Just small things. That's why it's called reasonable accommodation, because it means try to do it without using a lot of money, but be considerate about making access possible to others. We've been told when we did stakeholder consultations, so think about children. How do you make your services more accessible to them, young people? Instead of having global messaging, try to tweak your messages so that all people. Language, we have been told that we were always worried about our 12 official languages. There's a huge French-speaking group in South Africa today. How do we, within reasonableness, provide some services that take into account those other languages? But all of it is about trying not to go beyond what you can afford. Stick to being reasonable in whatever you do. How long will your budget review take to make sure that there's equity in the distribution of the pie? That's something we're looking at. Honourable Adams and Honourable Members, we're looking at that. In fact, this budget has already been tweaked to achieve that. I must say, though, that we are looking at both population and other measures, because sometimes population is small, but distances are vast. If you look at Northern Cape, our budget also takes into account that just to go for a clinic, they have to drive 400 kilometres, and they have to sleep somewhere. So the budget would take into account the field work, which, of course, if you're in Gauteng, you have lots of people to save, but your costs in terms of transport and accommodation are not going to be the same as someone in Mpumalanga who's going to drive from Nelspruit to Barberton or from Nelspruit to Piet Retief, you know, Etiquette. And so those are things. But we are looking into The CFO is looking at an equitable share of the cake, and you did say we should stay close and keep coming back to talk to that. We are going to keep coming back to you about that. Honourable Machake, the PDMS, is it old, is it new? The system is fairly new. It was introduced in 2009, just shortly before I came in. But I think the problem has just been around, because the policy itself, we have found that the policy is fair. It links everything to the vision, to the strategy. What we found that was a difficulty was the part of the policy around what do we reward. If, for example, you want to reward justice, you can't then have a reward for speed only, because our process 90 cases per week. You process 2 cases per week. But perhaps none of the 90 cases I did gave anyone justice. And then they're going to come back, the feisty ones come back and say, this is not justice. What you did is not, and then they start educating you about what the Constitution requires you to do for them. And often they are right. Now, already you have rewarded your investigator for processing 90 cases. So you've rewarded for efficiency, but your strategy talks about efficiency and effectiveness. And your strategy talks about justice for all. So we try just to make those alignments that we reward exactly according to the strategy. So it's really tweaking the system without necessarily killing the fundamentals of the system.
Do I therefore understand you well, that you're saying that the current performance management system is not having any standard measures that may be acceptable for the kind of work that you're doing, and this is why therefore you're reviewing?
It has measures. They are not totally in sync with the outcomes we want. So in other words, there is a system, but the alignment is not full. So we talk about a strategy. It's all what we call part of our strategy alignment process. That if we make 3 promises, and we've made only 3 promises to the people of South Africa, is that all of you, not one, not a selected few, all of you will get, in this current year, we have said all of you will get prompt remedial action. Not a portion of the cases. So if we give you 90 cases, we're promising that everyone who's going to come to you will get prompt remedial action. We will...
I understand that, yes. But is the review then going to address the concerns that you're actually putting forward
it's
now?
It's been addressing precisely that. And then I said, Honorable Machake, I said, the advice we got was that let's not just go on the administrative bill, let's go into value changing, because you raise the question of morale, because the world goes without this, that's in the system. It's there, there's nothing in the system that says I should be punished for comebacks. There's nothing that's written in that system that says if I did some well and then 10 came back unhappy, there should be consequences for that. And there were those that also said there isn't anything in that system that says there should be consequences for cases that are dragging for 27 months. There should be consequences for not giving feedback to complainants. And yet it was there. It was all of it. It was there because we have a service charter. So we're just pulling things together now and tightening up so that your performance agreement covers everything, your strategic objectives, the things that are already there in our service charter. When we reward you, we reward you because really, really, you delivered excellent service to everyone who came through your hands.
Going back to my question about ITC?
Yes.
Or technology within the office, are you going to have electronic assessment tool? Just to also be in the position to address that.
We have part of the, thank you for giving me that opportunity, because I forgot that part of the new system includes a balance scorecard, which is partly electronic and partly obviously a human assessment thing. So that's the total package. But the emphasis on values is for people, everyone in my system, buying into that it is the right thing to do. So not just a punitive thing that says if you didn't return messages to people, then you got to be punished. It's really building that core of people who say we are here to serve. We are a purpose-driven organization. That's how we're driving it now. Right. Thank you, Honorable Machake. What building do we want? We haven't decided on the building. We have decided on space and what are our needs. Remember, we don't want to do what we red card people for doing. So ours is demand management. We have indicated basically the specs that we want. We have a document that documents our needs in terms of including mediation rooms or all kinds of chambers that allows multiple mediation situations, because at the moment most we have our conference room and then the boardroom. And then if there are mediations that are taking place at the level of various investigators, and I am mediating, the DCP is mediating, we don't have enough space to do that. So we're looking at
it. It has been costed, that document. Will you be privy to it?
It hasn't been costed. But if you, because it's a process, we can finalize the process. The costed document we heard was one based on adjusting the current building to meet our needs. But that did not reconcile with our previous decision to move towards a state-owned building. So we do have a document that looks at what would it take to adjust the current building, and therefore enriching whoever owns the building to meet our needs. Yes, ma'am. But I think the team can estimate, because obviously it would be an estimate in terms of what the market is going to cost, and then we can provide it. But I like the questioning, because it shows, yes, that Parliament is going to support us in trying to move to...
No, it's not a suggestion, it's just to be fully informed about this that we are being requested to support.
Right. Thank you, Honourable Machar. And then the question you asked is, do we vote our staff? Yes, we do. We do, yeah. Do we have an electronic case management system? Yes, we have, but it was meant to be an CMS, but it has not worked according to plan. And the CEO was saying that we are looking at it within a month or so, being able to do what it is supposed to do. Our structure, it is included in the strat plan, Honourable Machake, on page... of the, it is on page 45 of the broadly, that's our structure between page 45 and page 46 of the office.
The question was related to structure. Actually, I was making reference to mention of review of salary just of the Deputy Public Protector.
Pardon me?
The question around structure was going back to the comment on review of the salary of the Deputy Public Protector.
Oh, on the public talking, something that the portfolio is seized with, the review of the salary of the... It's an old story that we've asked the committee, and the committee did do it last time. It did engage. It was just a request that that process be finalized. In terms of the approved structure at the moment that we're supposed to implement, which has now been approved by DPSA, and then I've now requested financing on it, but I'm now entitled to implement it partially with whatever money I have, the CEO becomes a DG, and automatically the CEO is senior to the DPP. Because that process, that parliamentary process is still coming. This one has not been concluded. The new structure I have a CEO at a level of a DG, which is appropriate because all other institutions, or most institutions that do the work we do are headed by a CEO. When he writes his dear colleague letter to the Foresight colleagues, he's writing a dear colleague letter to colleagues, in trying to get them to do the right thing. So, but I'm glad you raised that question, because it gives me an opportunity to just remind Parliament of that small business of ours that we need to conclude. Thank you, ma'am. Right. How long does it take before we respond to a complaint? We have a service charter. Responding to a complaint is something we do within about 24 hours. You get a letter of acknowledgement. But our service promise itself gives us about 5 days or so. So, but we respond within 7 hours. I am not aware of anyone who never received a a letter of acknowledgement for a year and was never informed that the matter has been assessed. I do know that between December last year and sometime in February, that's when our system was done, and we had a backlog, and that's when then our intake assessment and customer service manager came with the plan that instead of trying to keep lifting the system that would keep going up and down and then eventually it just packed, she was going to do things manually, which she did. But that was the first, and we immediately then approached our stakeholders, the affected persons, to indicate what had been the impediment. But in any system, that's why you have quality assurance. In any system, a system fails now and again. So if there is a case, Honorable Machake, that you know of, that you would like to bring to our attention, we would want to handle it. Often when the service fails, like the matters are elevated to me or to the deputy, although we have the customer service unit that deals with these things, but we step in, we apologize to the complainant, and we deal with it. Often complainants think they didn't get a response when it was posted and it wasn't, it didn't arrive. Or it was an email and they wrote one character in the email was not right and it didn't reach any of us often, and then we request them to please resend, and then we apologize again, even though it wasn't our fault, we apologize that the system failed. But part of the surveys that we did just now, last year, was to look at also the level at which we are being we're servicing our people. The third one that we did was employee behavior survey, which was a difficult one. And even though it was difficult, it was done internally by the Deputy Public Protector, which was looking at the kinds of behavior that we need to have to deliver according to the promises versus some of the patterns of behavior that are not in sync with that. So it's a frank internal assessment. The document is available, but we don't want to distribute it widely, but it has given us the kind of feedback to say, what do we do as a team? How do we improve where there are gaps? Right. The Department of Justice is resuscitating advice centers. Honorable Chairperson, we would talk about that. I would just say that we would look at that, obviously, without necessarily undermining arm's length between us and certain organs of state, but we can always piggyback. In the same way that we're looking at two songs, we can piggyback on anyone, as long as it doesn't impair the understanding that we are a separate institution from the executive organs of state in particular that we oversee. Yes. But yeah, we would take any opportunity to serve people better. And then I think that was the last question. And then I think I answered the last question from you, Honorable Chairperson, around SWAT. From Honorable SWAT, yes. Certainly, Honorable SWAT. Thank you again for the positive feedback. You asked the question, Honorable SWAT, around do we now get a better implementation of our findings and remedial action? And yes, we do. We just want to make sure that all of them, though, get immediate, because often, as the Chinese say, it's a grain of sand that can tip the scales of justice. This is what happens here. Just time could be of the essence, especially when people are owed monies for employment. You know, they have been out of employment. They often are at a point where they're about to lose their homes. And that's another area for accessibility for us, that people, we need them to know and come to us timeously, because often they come when they have the papers, they've brought them to us and say, they are foreclosing on me, the sheriff is standing, and they owe me money, and we find that they legitimately are owed the money. So that's why it matters to us that it should happen timelessly. How our relationship with the monitoring, Honourable Saad, was it about the monitoring office of government?
The unit in the Speaker's office.
We have worked very well with the unit in the Speaker's office insofar as making sure that they are informed of what they're doing and then providing us with the necessary support as a Chapter 9 institution. And they are moving into an area now where they intending occasionally to have meetings with all of us as Chapter 9s. To meet with the director at that office is Chatuna. But so far we've had quite a supportive relationship. I can just say what we've received from our side is a very supportive relationship from their side. No reason to complain. And often actually complaints, if you're talking about complaints that are not heavy, often actually sometimes if they're not heavy, they go to that unit to say, we're not getting justice from the one of the offices of the public protector. Can you have them look at this? And we do that. Have you, okay, now I've dealt with the one about a contempt, but it's hard power that you don't want to use unnecessarily, because it's really like having a gun, is that you really have to pull it when it's absolutely necessary to pull it, isn't it? I'm not suggesting that anyone should use a gun ever to start. Yes. And thank you so much, Honourable Swart, about the questions about proposals to amend legislation, because that's one of our achievements, actually. In the actual report, we have highlighted that, is that we've not just made an impact on individual cases and trying to ensure justice, whether we assist with someone to get justice as a person, or we assist the state to avoid losing resources. We've also, when appropriate, we've made observations, systemic observations into policies. We've made observations into era of the Executive Members Ethics Act. At the level of policy, we've made observations in the area of procurement, particularly procurement of office accommodation for the state, and we made suggestions on what could be changed, and there has been a whole lot of responses there that have been positive. At the level of legislation, one area that we have made suggestion in, I have made those suggestions, and my predecessor made suggestions as well in 2005, is witness protection. There are problems, and justice also admits there are problems, and I'm happy to say that there is a positive attitude from his side in terms of reviewing the policies and reviewing the law, and partly in the interest of justice, but also partly in the interest of protecting whistleblowers, because they stick out their necks and then the system often doesn't treat them kindly. Based on a trip we heard recently to Wisconsin in the USA, we brought back legislation that when we do our annual report, Honorable Chairperson, we're going to make a proposal that is seriously considered it, about protection of whistleblowers. There's two areas that we've come back with that we've adopted in our EXCO yesterday when we gave the report. Was one, improve the protection of whistleblowers. Because they're never fired because they whistleblow, they're always fired under pretexts. So what we found there was that they had better understanding in the law around what is called pretext accusations, you know, where really the reason is you whistleblow, but we invent another reason why we should now suddenly remember your previous transgressions. So we saw that and we thought we would like to bring to the attention of Parliament and say, it could be taken into account in the review of the PDA, Protective Disclosures Act. The second thing that we found that we really think could help in the fight against corruption, which you asked again, Honorable Swart, is giving whistleblowers some of the money that they help recover from the state. That's another thing we found that most states... Yeah, we saw the U.S. actually in their fight. It's amazing actually that corruption is a global thing. I mean, the stories we heard today were quite amazing. But part of the thing, because gratitude doesn't pick much of your corruption and fraud, and whistleblowers are your main ally, then the incentive there is that if the state prosecutes successfully, they get 25%. If the state issues a nolle prosequi and they prosecute themselves, private prosecution, they get 40%. So considering that actually it is a perilous journey to be a whistleblower, perhaps it wouldn't be too bad to provide something. So that's one area, Honorable Chairperson, that could be considered as part of a partnership between civil society and the state. In, what is our mandate regarding the SIU? Really, it's a small mandate there. It's really just, the SIU provides that every time the president issues a proclamation, I must be informed. Because I suspect that the drafters of the legislation were making sure that there isn't parallel duplication, and if there is a short space, then we should work together. Or hand over or something like that. So that I think was the thinking of the drafters of the legislation. And it is true we have all of these other mandates, and two of those mandates though we would be happy if Parliament considered migrating them elsewhere. There are two mandates that we would be happy to part with. One is the PIA mandate. The other one was the Home Builders, the Protection of Housing Measures Act. Exactly, because it's a review, it's an important function though that Parliament should consider having a tribunal to review the decisions of the Home Builders of the Registration Council, because it's really mislocated. I had one case now that has been reviewed by our staff, but I mean, we're not really geared to do that. It's a special skill, and it needs attention considering how people get shortchanged in the housing industry, really. So that's another, those are two areas that I would part ways with. In terms of strengthening legislation, we will bring up during our annual report.
Just to interrupt, are you saying that you'd be happy to have the buyer mandate moved from your office?
Yes.
Has that been discussed probably maybe with the Forum for Chapter 9s, and what's the feeling?
I think both of you must address the chair.
Yes.
Conversation.
Basically, it's from the concern. Just why I have to express the concern as to whether this has been discussed in the Forum for Chapter 9s, and what is the feeling generally on that?
No. I have not discussed it with Chapter 9, because I'm not saying it should be taken away from Chapter 9, ma'am. I'm simply saying if Parliament so wishes, it should be taken away from the public protector, because it's such an important mandate, and we are essentially an ombudsman institution. And I do know in other countries they have the ombudsman also as an information regulator, but I think we have our hands full. So it's, for me, in respect of that mandate, it is an important mandate that I think it would be better performed elsewhere. Because if I look at, for example, information provision, because part of performing a mandate, a legislative mandate, is also being able to educate the sector about that mandate, to empower people to use that mandate. We've not been able to do that. And the people that have done excellently in this area are ODEC. And so we rely on them. And because we perform our role primarily as an ombudsman institution. So, but it's not like I'm saying it should be taken away from other Chapter 9. I'm only saying it should be taken away from our office, from the public protector office. If Parliament so wishes.
No.
But that's a by and by, Chairperson. It's not really. It's something we can discuss, Honourable Members, when we present our annual report, and then we can provide further information about that.
And that also includes that home builders registration and the Home Housing Measures Protection Act mandate. And then Honourable Swart, you were asking what's our relationship with the SIU. We had a good relationship with the SIU, and with all of the integrity institutions, be it SIU, HOCS, NPA, etc. Some of the Public Service Commission, we have mostly bilateral agreements with them, but through our good governance initiative, we are fostering a process that allows us to segment those relationships as a group and not just only as individuals. But as individuals, like with the SIU, we do have a bilateral agreement, and we do joint investigate. We've done collaborative investigations on some of these cases, and we've shared information where necessary. That is just generally the approach, and sometimes we don't move in. For example, DPW will ask one of the complainants to do a systemic on all of the leases. After we did the subs ones, they asked us to do all of the leases to look at whether they were not also issued wrongfully, and then the first thing we had to look at what has the SIU done so that we don't repeat what the SIU has done, and we found that they're working on that area. An increase in the number, Honourable Swart, you asked if there should be a decrease in the number of cases if ADR is working. There should be an increase in the number of cases finalized if ADR is working. That's true. That's absolutely true. But this is what you talk about inertia when you're talking about change, because as we're increasing ADR, we're also increasing the quality of investigations. So whereas it used to be very fast to investigate where you operated more or less like a call center, some of the investigations are taking longer to conclude, to the complex ones, because the investigator has to look at the law and has to often go beyond the documents supplied by the state and interview witnesses if necessary. We don't just do it because we have to if necessary. So in balancing rigor with promptness, we're always talking about balancing rigor with promptness. There has been a bit of a challenge now. Hence, we're going forward, we need to increase our investigation capacity, both in terms of numbers and skills. But we're handling the skills part, because we've done sharpen your teeth. We're now going to look at skills training, which includes simulations, helping working with the investigators. Our next training is on the 8th of May. We're looking more at not just information sharing, but skills. And then I've answered Honourable Swart the question that we had about access to classified information. At the moment, it has never been raised as a big issue. There has been cases where somebody pleads classified, but I would say to them, I would alert them to the Constitution and to the Public Protector Act that says I can subpoena any information in the Republic if that information is going to shed light into a matter that I'm investigating. We don't even want to subpoena bank records and cell phone records. We don't have to go Section 205 of the Criminal Procedure Act. I have an equivalent provision in the Public Protector Act that says I can subpoena, so I will use the Public Protector Act. Because the thinking then was the Public Protector should be an institution that has similar ability in terms of asking questions to a judge, although different ability when it comes to enforcement. Thank you, Honourable Chairperson.
Thank you, Public Protector. Honourable members and ladies and gentlemen, this is really for the Honourable Majeka. A decision in principle has already been taken that the power to deal with prior complaints be removed from the Public Protector's Office and from the Human Rights Commission. That power will be placed in the hands of the Office of the Information Regulator. All this is contained in a bill that is presently before this committee. It's called the Protection of Personal Information Bill. The committee, before I became chair, in its wisdom chose to refer that bill to a subcommittee comprising Mr. John Jeffrey, the Honourable Dean Smuts, and the Honourable Mario Ambrosini. And they have been running with the bill. It's at an advanced stage. I think we're at the point where we're about to ask them to present a report to the committee. So it's practically fait accompli. However, establishing that office is going to take some years. So unfortunately, for some years, you will still be lumped with that responsibility. So you know, it's not a question of, sure. All I'm saying is, it's not a question of, well, you've given it to the info regulator, and whether they're up and running or not, I wish I could say, yes, that is so, but it isn't, unfortunately. So that's where we stand.
Thank you, Chair. Looking forward to engagement in the next meeting.
Good. All right. Honourable members? Yes, I know, but, you know, we only see the public protector once or twice a year. Members.
We may need to have a government or chapter 9 precinct. Like at the moment, we had a 9-year lease with the private sector. Over this period, we've paid about close to 30 million in terms of the rental. And that will definitely translate into a good building forever. Now, if we're to renew for another 10 years or 9 years, we'll end up paying about 60 million, which is about 2 buildings. At the moment, we have an increase in our staff complements, and then they said, look, we can increase it for free to extend the lease, for instance, with the needs that we have. So obviously they definitely want us to increase the lease, but obviously we will be meeting with public works presenting our needs as well, and see what we are bound to ask them to look for the building for us and do it for ourselves, but we are in that particular situation. that's why the public works keep on reminding us. So that's why we're giving everything to the public works to do it.
Yambos. In the same way that I have very little confidence in CETA, I have even less confidence in public works. Now, you've done your maths, and you've said in the last 9 years you've paid a lease, and it's amounted to so much. You could have taken that money and bought a brand new piece of land and put up your own headquarters. For me, that is motivation enough. You don't need any more motivation. All you have to do is do the math. You'd actually be saving money. Unfortunately, you go to public works, well, they don't believe in saving money. They believe in enriching certain individuals who own buildings in Pretoria, and that you must lease those buildings from them. We're not happy about that. So, if necessary, well, let's look at calling them before us.
Yes.
You mean in Pretoria?
No.
Are they leasing the building?
Yes, it is. They move away from the Constitutional Court precinct. And there's maybe only one Chapter 9 left there because they kept on expanding and the precinct wasn't expanding enough. Even ourselves, we've moved downtown.
Well, maybe we should look at if we ever do implement Chapter 9 review regularly, but nothing's have changed. If we ever make an umbrella body, although you weren't trying to be interested, but in some other countries, the human rights and ombudsmen are together. But I don't know, maybe if we end up amalgamating some institutions, we should do the language and the. And the vision
of the culture into the human rights. Maybe there's an argument then for buying a building for Chapter 9 and then giving half to Ms. Manon.
The
Honourable J.B. Sibagnoni has pleaded with me to allow him one final little question.
it's a little question. I just want to find out what has been the impact of your adjusting, more especially in those areas where you have closed the offices. Have you succeeded to ensure that you don't leave people outside? For example, specifically, I'm thinking about Siyabuswa. What has been the impact of those?
The plan is simple, that we're not going to leave, but we're going to have clinics that we're going to go there maybe twice a week or once, depending on the people. That's Siyabuswa, of course, and Mabubani. That basically, depending on the kind of work, we keep on going there once a week, using the Tucson centers and taking complaints. That's basically what we're doing, and that will help us in terms of realigning the budget, as Honourable Member Adams was saying. In fact, the fact that Western Cape may get less than Mpumalanga, that will be addressed. But at the same time, it does not necessarily mean that Western Cape end up not doing its work. In fact, they get almost all the work. It's just in terms of what the numbers reflect, but they are well serviced, just like Mpumalanga, like any other provinces. It's not that they may not have a fax, or they don't have a computer, or they cannot do their clinics. They get almost everything. It's just what the number is reflecting at the moment.
Just to also say, Honourable Chairperson, we have not implemented yet. So we're still looking at all of those logistics. What BC is talking about is in the written plan, because everything had to be done in a plan, and then consultations with the communities also were taking place around what really is the caseload. In addition to mobile clinics, we are also looking at agency arrangements within a localized place, where they don't have to come only on the date we are there. They can leave the complaint with someone else. That's where we are looking at these agency arrangements. Thank you.
Honourable Members, we're just about done. I had a quiet word with the Honourable Dean Smuts, Mr. Swart. The Minister posed the question whether he is able to address us on Thursday morning as opposed to Thursday afternoon. We don't have a caucus on Thursday, neither do the DA, and we were wondering, is that okay? Well, let's see what he's, Mr. Romano's negotiations with the Office of the Minister can.
I don't do morning.
10 o'clock. We'll try 10 o'clock. Public Protector, let me close by thanking you and everyone that is with you. We, as usual, we remain impressed with the work your office is doing, and long may it continue. It goes without saying that you have the support of this committee in just about everything that you do. And so when it comes to requests such as contained in your report this morning, we'll give it very serious consideration. I do have one little note that I'm going to pass to you, and I want you to read it and then decide how you want to deal with it. I don't want to make it public here because it's not appropriate. And so we're adjourned. Thank you.